From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're celebrating the 15th anniversary of Napoleon Dynamite. This is a show for those who know the film and love it. And of course, you know it's about an awkward kid with a tight perm in Preston, Idaho. The director and co-writer Jared and Jerusha Hess will join us to talk about creating the character of Napoleon. And John Heater will also be with us to talk about bringing to life someone with such mad skills. We'll be right back.
I'm Andrew Becker, the news director here at KUER. Our newsroom is growing, with new reporters set to join us in the coming months. In the meantime, we want to know, what issues should we be covering where you live? What stories should we be telling in your community? Help us improve our coverage of Utah by answering a few short questions. Go to KUER.org and click Community Feedback Form under the About tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A guy's gotta have skills. Napoleon Dynamite knows it.
Well, nobody's gonna go out with me.
Have you asked anybody yet?
No, but who would? I don't even have any good skills.
What do you mean?
You know, like nunchuck skills, bow hunting skills, computer hacking skills. Girls only want boyfriends who have great skills.
It's just one moment from the indie film that still gets quoted, and if you're a fan, you may have your own favorite lines you ran with friends when it came out 15 years ago. Let's see. Can you bring me my chapstick? I caught you a delicious bass. It's hard to believe it's been 15 years, but yeah. It was 2004 when Jared and Jerusha Hess and their team of newbies, a lot of them BYU students, got the film into Sundance, and it became the talk of the festival, and studios got in a bidding war, and it took off. It made $44 million. Today in the program, we're going to celebrate the anniversary of the film. The Utah Film Center is gathering some of the cast members for a screening tomorrow night. John Heater, Napoleon, will be there. Efren Ramirez, Pedro, will too. The actors who played Kip and LaFonda and Trisha, which is pretty cool. And we'll give you the details about that in a moment, but this is a pretty good excuse to talk about Napoleon Dynamite. And I guess it goes without saying that if you haven't seen it yet, we're going to spoil it today, so there's your warning. We're going to begin with a conversation with Darryl Larson, who is a professor of the Media Arts Department in the Center for Animation at Brigham Young University. If you encountered someone, and I'm sure they still exist, who didn't really know what Napoleon Dynamite was, how would you describe it to him? How do you say what this thing is?
Napoleon Dynamite is one of those characters who's the ultimate outsider, I suppose. He is the outsider who manages to become a focus of attention, not necessarily initially in a negative way, but eventually in a positive way. And it's kind of interesting how many times he is cited as a positive character in educational journals, in behavioral type journals, that sort of thing. He's used over and over again.
Do you agree with that?
I do. I see him as it's the way it's structured. He starts out as the focus of negative attention, of course, right? The first couple of times we see him, he struggles on the bus. He struggles in front of a locker by being bullied. He struggles with someone kicking him for his tater tots and things like that. But eventually you clearly see that those encounters aren't what inform his character. They don't create him. They don't mold him in a negative kind of way. He moves beyond them very quickly or lets them flow around him.
Is he self-aware? And does that matter?
At certain levels, yes, he certainly is self-aware, because you can see when he's performing in, in the Happy Hands moments, or there are moments in the film where he is clearly performing and he's clearly doing something where he acknowledges the fact that someone in the room has a negative reaction to what he's doing. So he's not totally unaware that other people disagree with what he's doing or have some sort of reaction to it. So he's not so far gone or somewhere on some spectrum that he doesn't understand that there are those that are disagreeing with what he's doing or see what he's doing as odd. But clearly that doesn't deter him. He continues to move forward, and I think that's the strength of his character.
Is Napoleon Dynamite as a character in a piece of art unique? Have we ever seen anything quite like it? Do you ever have, are there other characters in other films that you compare him to?
Right off the top of my head, I'm not thinking of other characters very, very specifically that I could name. I see other types of characters that are pilloried, I suppose, socially, or are banged about or buffeted by the world around them, but they don't stop. They continue to move forward. They have a goal. They have a prize. I think at some point in the film, I think it's right before Pedro is supposed to perform, or Pedro is supposed to speak, and he says something along the lines of, follow your dream or go after your heart. It's what I do. That's sort of his mantra, and you believe it. He actually does that. That's sort of the way he lives his life. It's not said in an ironic way.
Pedro, just listen to your heart.
It's a terrific moment in the film.
It really is. To me, it seemed like the sort of really critical moment, I have to say, for me, just in terms of saying something that tied all of these vignettes together.
Correct. And then he goes out and does something that's completely self-effacing, that is completely embarrassing, and that most of us who identify with him, and I recognize this character. I went to a similar high school, a rural high school in a rural setting with similar kinds of kids, and I understand what he's feeling. And I look at this character and I think he's bolder than I was, and he's doing things that I wish I could have done. And I think that this could empower, this could give kids something to aspire to, give them someone to look at and say, yep, that's a kid I want to be like. That's a character that I can admire.
Let's talk about the film itself, not just the character of Napoleon. Why do you think it resonated so much culturally in popular American popular culture? Why did it work so well, like it seemed to do, do you think?
Well, let's see. It came out in, about 2004?
Yeah.
It was a very small film. It was from an unknown filmmaker. It's from outside the system, from the studio system. It was one of the earlier films that emerged from the film festival circuit, one of those. And nowadays we're used to hearing about the major purchases from the Sundance and the Toronto and the South by Southwest, that sort of circuit of film festivals.
Yeah, but this was before that.
This was at the beginning of that sort of excitement. And it created that sort of that sort of excitement. And I think what we've seen since is, and I know I've heard it since, critics and industry pundits saying maybe this is this year's Napoleon Dynamite. We keep hearing this since then. So it's clearly become some sort of benchmark, a term that's used to talk about the industry itself. It's probably also significant in that it's a film that is a comedy that is pushing boundaries and that is continuing to resonate. It's a fun film. It's an uplifting film. It's a film that reminds us that we can laugh at ourselves. We can laugh at and with these characters because we are laughing at them to a certain extent, but we are clearly not meant to be laughing derisively at these characters, and we're not meant to be poking fun at them necessarily. We are meant to laugh with them as they grow and enjoy their time in this very, very challenging high school setting that we all then recognize and remember, and it takes us back to a certain time. It's not what you call a very a topical film. It's not going to age dramatically.
It seems timeless.
I think it will continue to be timeless. As you think about the film, I was rewatching it recently. You think about the film, it talks about certain dates. Uncle Rico talks about 1982, if only he could go back. And of course, the film was released long after 1982. And the decor and the props and the costumes, et cetera, everything is pulled from multiple times.
Yeah.
As if there's a sort of cornucopia of time and it's all flowing out of it.
Yep.
And so there's no. there's no chance that it's going to be trapped in a particular time with a particular poster or president or whatever happens to be that's going to grab a particular time. So I think it will continue to be timeless in the shirts that he's wearing, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to be a film that I think will continue to work for a long period of time because it's not trapped in any particular time.
The thing I wondered about was you mentioned it being uplifting, and I guess that's right. And I'm sure a lot of people see it that way. But there's also, it seemed like there was this counterpoint to that where there was this strong sense of irony, I thought. There was this kind of ambivalence, this almost pushback against anything terribly sentimental. There was this deep, real authenticity. It was slice of life. These were vignettes that in some cases didn't really seem to be going anywhere except for just presenting this moment. And I wondered if that was part of its appeal, too, is that it may have been uplifting or it may have presented something positive ultimately, but that didn't beat you over the head with it. Maybe that was part of its appeal, do you think?
I think so. I think the surprise of Napoleon's performance late in the film was only really surprising and only really worked because we have a series of encounters.
You mean the dance?
Yeah, the dance.
Yep, sorry. Yeah.
We had a series of encounters that in no way prepared us for that performance.
Right.
And so there's no way we could have been prepared when Napoleon and Kip were testing out Uncle Rico's time machine, for example, or La Fonda got off the bus in the very much wider Preston, Idaho, or they were just sitting in the cafeteria at high school and talking about tater tots. None of these small vignettes were telling us that there was going to be a completely selfless moment that all the kids in that gym, perhaps excepting the bully, would recognize as a moment that one character, Napoleon, was going to surrender any thread or vestige of self-respect that he might have for himself, for his friend. And then that would be celebrated by everybody in that auditorium. Now, if that had been one that had been building and had been prepped and had been telegraphed to us in a what you might call a very typical sort of Hollywood screenplay sort of way, it wouldn't have worked nearly as well.
Yeah. It sneaks up on you.
It does sneak up on it. And the fact that Napoleon is training for us, in his dance sequence, we have no clue what he is training for. That's on purpose. He is dancing, and he tells us that he's dancing. He tells La Fonda that he's dancing, but we don't know what he's dancing for. The opportunity presents itself. He dances. He dances for his friend, and as it turns out, it works out very well. And as a matter of fact, it's not even an ideal performance. If you remember the performance, the music gets cut off, perhaps accidentally, perhaps on purpose, and he, in a very Napoleon characteristic sort of way, runs off the side.
Yeah.
He has to run off to the side.
Yeah.
And so it even ends badly. But then, of course, thunderous applause. And that's the way it needs to end as the students acknowledge just what he's done for his friend. So a perfect gesture for Pedro.
I think a lot of people who live in the Intermountain West and who are familiar with the rural parts of the Intermountain West, a lot of these Mormon communities are going to recognize Preston or whatever place that was. I know it's Preston, but do you think that for people who live outside of this area, did they recognize that as being in any way culturally Mormon or particularly rural? I mean, do you know what I mean? Did it resonate in that way, do you think? Or what do you think about that?
I do. I know I'm from Central California, living in this area, but I'm from Central California. I very, very much recognized that town, that setting. I think that the film was picked up, I believe it was MTV Films who were interested in the film. And they knew that their audience, which is perhaps a more urban-centered audience, a younger, hipper, if you will, urban-centered audience, would identify with this character and this young, hip, urban-centered audience clearly didn't grow up in this sort of setting, but they were going to be attracted to this character, and it wouldn't necessarily have been the setting. They knew that the Napoleon character was going to be a character that they were going to be interested in, the quirkiness of the character, but probably the resolvedness of that character, the fact that the character could be stepped on, if you will, by life, and was going to be resilient, was going to be able to get right back up and continue going. One of those terrific moments as I was watching it recently reminded me of when he's trying to get to the dance and he's walking down the road in his great suit and having the carnation, and there he's by himself, and then he gets picked up. There's this great resolve. He knows, it's as if he knows the world is going to somehow take care of him. And sure enough, he gets a ride from Pedro's cousins, and there he gets to the dance with his girlfriend. It's a terrific image there that Jared created, probably based on memories from his own past.
Yep.
But those kinds of images are not ones that you would say, oh, that's a natural flow from A to B to C that you would imagine in a scripted kind of world. These are these sort of disparate magpie images that kind of come together in a very, very magical sort of way in this, that create this kind of world, a hodgepodge world, but it works very, very well for Napoleon's world that then culminates in this dance and performance and in a very, very memorable sort of way. So, yeah, this is a terrific way. It's very identifiable, and I don't think you have to be from this area to recognize it. I don't think you have to be to know that it's from southern Idaho. I don't think any of that really matters. Yeah. The good, strong writing of the character speaks well beyond that.
So let me come back to this question finally. And it's something you were referring to earlier, but I want to ask it again. And I know it's kind of a dumb, boring question, you know, the question, does it hold up today? But do you think it holds up in the same way culturally, where it fit for its time? Does it resonate with a new generation of filmgoers who are going to encounter this thing not in the same way that others did, you know, 15 years ago? Mm-hmm. Does it hold up in the same way, or can anything ever hold up in the same way?
I think it does hold up. Number one, like we already said, the fact that it is timeless, that it's not going to date itself, is significant. I don't think a lot of filmmakers don't think about that as they're making their films. They think topicality is absolutely crucial, not realizing that the dating part of it is something that is can be damaging and limiting as you finish your film. That's one thing. Second thing is, we're thinking about this film as a first film from a sort of independent filmmaker.
Yeah.
And you say to yourself, can you put this up on the same level with, oh, I don't know, take a Terrence Malick who brought out Badlands in 1973, or think of where Gus Van Sant was when he was making his first film in the 70s, or David Lynch was with Eraserhead. And you think of those early filmmakers, or Wes Anderson and Bottle Rocket and those kinds of films, and say, can you put it with those films and say those kinds of films are still films you can discuss thoughtfully and seriously alongside Napoleon Dynamite now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now? I think the answer would absolutely be yes. Those films are all going to stand up. Those filmmakers are working in and outside the studio system. They're making the films they want to make. This film, Napoleon Dynamite, is one of those films that is holding up. It's a different kind of film because he started out with a comedy. Jared did, and he's continued to make comedies, but it is continuing to be a strong film that is saying important things about character and important things about kids as they fit in or don't fit in and how they then react to that situation. So, yes, I think the answer is it will continue to resonate and continue to be a strong film as we move forward.
That's Darrell Larson. He's a film professor at Brigham Young University. So tomorrow, the Utah Film Center is hosting a 15th anniversary screening of Napoleon Dynamite. It's at East High School in Salt Lake City. This is a fundraiser for the Utah Film Center, and as I said before, a lot of the cast and crew from the film are going to be there. So if you can, you should go. You'll find details about it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER is listener-supported public radio. And our most dependable support comes from our nearly 9,000 sustainers, people just like you who make ongoing monthly contributions. Starting at just $5 a month, you can become a sustainer too. Go to KUER.org, click on the donate button, and tell us how you'd like to contribute. Use your credit card or make it even easier with a direct withdrawal from your bank account. Join our growing community of sustainers today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're celebrating the 15th anniversary of Napoleon Dynamite, which became a phenomenon when it premiered at Sundance. But it had humble beginnings made by a team of young BYU students about an awkward kid with a tight perm in Preston, Idaho. The Utah Film Center is having a special screening of the film tomorrow night, and they've invited some of the creators and actors from the film. Napoleon will be there, Kip, Pedro, LaFonda. We'll give you details about that a little bit later. But today on the program, we're talking about the film, like where it came from and why it worked so well. Joining us now on the program is Jared Hess, who directed Napoleon Dynamite, which he co-wrote with his wife, Jerusha. I'll introduce her in a moment here. But Jared Hess, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug.
Jerusha Hess also did the costume design for the film as far as... along with co-writing it. And welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We have Jeremy Kuhn with us, who produced the film. Jeremy, welcome to you.
Thanks for having us.
And John Heater is with us, of course, played Napoleon. He's joining us from a studio in Southern California. John, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
So I guess I wanted to start with when you hear people like Darl and me talking about archetypes and where it fit in the culture. Was it anything at all, Jared, I'll start with you on this question, something you had imagined would be happening, that people would be writing papers about the character of Napoleon Dynamite, like when you were putting this thing together?
Not at all. I mean, we were just a bunch of young and dumb film students trying to make our first film. So everything that happened after it, you know, totally unexpected.
What about you?
The whole point was just to make a funny movie. Every scene that was written was, how do we make this funny? What's a funny thing that could happen to Napoleon? So, I mean, of course, he was following, you know, a trajectory that we had planned, but it's all fun to hear the critical analysis of Napoleon.
Yeah. John, what about you when you hear people breaking down your character in college papers and stuff?
I think it's awesome because, like, I'm so... you know, I've answered these questions 10,000 times with the same answer, and this is all new material for me. So thanks, Darl, for, you know, equipping me with all new answers. This is great. like some real deep stuff in there that, you know, I think I may have missed or didn't really think about it.
So, Jared and Jerusha, I wanted to ask you, what kinds of films did you have in mind that you wanted to make? Right before Napoleon or in that time before, like what were the films that you were thinking about making in those days?
You know, for the longest time growing up as a kid, I thought I wanted to be a visual effects supervisor. I was really into special effects, really into like stop motion animation, had all the industrial light and magic coffee table books. So I thought I wanted to do Spielberg, George Lucas type movies, go to film school, thought that I wanted to be a cinematographer, but I destroyed a number of student films with incorrect exposure and very shoddy camera work. But through that process, it was like, oh, man, I'm not having as much fun serving somebody else's idea that I'm not really that into. Yeah. And I've got stories on my own that I want to tell. And so, you know, film school is the place where you experiment. And for me, it was like, okay, I've got these dorky stories of my life growing up in rural Idaho. Maybe there's something there. And then that led to making a short film with John Heater. It was kind of our first stab at the character in the world. Mm-hmm. And we went up to my hometown in Preston to shoot the film on like a weekend. And John is a very handsome guy. But in college, he was a very handsome dude with long flowing hair. And we were like, gosh, how do we make John look like Napoleon and not John Heater? And Jerusha was like, we got to get that man a perm.
Yeah.
So she sent him to the Bon Lucy Hair Academy in Provo, Utah. For a tight perm.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history, yeah.
Yeah. What about you, Josh? What were the films? Were you? I mean, you were thinking comedies. You were thinking of realizing the vision of your husband about his childhood in Preston, Idaho, or what was
it? Yeah, I think we were always thinking comedy, but they were what you see is what we were thinking. Really small stories about small characters that we haven't seen before. And our short films were the same. They're always full of a lot of heart, but someone you haven't seen depicted on screen. So, yeah.
Yeah. As far as inspirations, you know, I remember, and I don't know if it was in, I think it was in Darryl's class, actually, one of his other film classes, they showed the Errol Morris documentary, The Gates of Heaven, which is a documentary about pet cemeteries and their weird kind of eccentric owners.
Yep.
And I just remember just the tone of that film and just being able to sit with these characters that you've never seen before, people that you'd never meet in real life, and getting the chance to get to know them and all their beautiful weirdness. And for me, that was kind of an inspiration in how we approach, you know, the photography and just kind of the tone of the film a little bit.
If I'm thinking back to those days and what films we were watching and were exposed to, because we were just, you know, these kids who hadn't seen a lot of films.
Yeah.
You aren't, you just, if you grow up in a typical Mormon family, you see the same Princess Bride over and over again.
Right.
And Willow, right?
Yeah. Right.
And so we were exposed to all these new movies in Darryl's class and all our other classes. And I remember also, if I'm thinking back to influences, I saw Hard Day's Night for the first time in film school and just being so like, this is the most amazing performative piece I've ever seen. And so maybe stuff like that influence, like why Napoleon has to dance in the end and people screaming. I'm sure all of them added to it.
Mm. Yeah.
One of the things when I'm talking to Darryl earlier is that he talks about it, and I think this is right. It's certainly the way people are seeing the film as being, you know, uplifting, or they're seeing, you know, the relating to Napoleon as this character who is an outsider, but Darryl talks about it as being really intentional. And I wondered, was it really intentional as you were thinking about it? Because one of the things I think, Jerusha, you've talked about is, you actually learned from, in Darryl's class, that you could create a character that was just passive, that didn't have that much of an intention necessarily, and maybe that was something you were interested in.
Yeah, I think we were learning about these volitional and non-volitional characters, and the character should not be passive. They should be, you know, working to get their dreams, you know, to have things come true. And we turned it on its head, and what happens to Napoleon if he does nothing?
Right. Did you consider that? That was your writing?
Yeah.
I mean, we knew we were doing it, and we were concerned. Like, oh, maybe.
Yeah, I mean,
problem.
You know, we kind of hit this point. Like, the character was so defined, and especially after we did the short film, and we really kind of nailed down who he was and how he sounded and looked and what his interests were. And with that in mind, like, as we started to develop the feature, we had more very plot-driven things. But we're like, gosh, if we commit this character to just this really intense, you know, plot, whatever it was, like, we're not, I don't know, being true to him just kind of drifting through high school, you know, mm-hmm. in the way that kids do.
Yep.
And so it you kind of become, I don't know, a slave to a plot line where this, you kind of, it becomes more of a portrait in a character study.
So it was exciting for you to think, we could make a film. It's kind of like Seinfeld, right? In some ways, like, nothing happens necessarily. We've got
all these
characters that have these interesting backstories and have these great traits, but nothing is really happening, and that can work. Mm-hmm. Did that excite you as a possibility?
I mean, I think we felt very excited, if I'm remembering.
Yeah.
It's been a long time.
I think it was really hard, though. We were also novice feature filmmakers. This was our first one. And so every scene was such hard work. And I think there's part of that why it wasn't plotty, because we were like, this is just too hard to do. But we could break it into little short films. Like, here's a little scene with him at the DI. We can write that scene.
Yeah.
And then let's go get a taco.
Yeah. Right.
So
pace yourself.
Yeah, it's funny how far we've come as writers now and how fast we are. Not that we're better, but we're just faster.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to get to, Jared, how you're thinking about this character of Napoleon, and John, the way he presents it to you and the way you're both thinking about it. Like, what, Jared, you start. Like, what was, it was a melange of different kinds of characters, right? Yeah.
So I come from a family of six boys, and I'm the oldest, and most of what Napoleon says and does is a direct transcript of me and my brothers growing up. So, like, my brother called me one time, and he was like, Jared, is Mom there? I'm like, no, she's not. She's in Logan. Can you bring me my chapstick? I mean, that was like a full-blown conversation. When he saw the film, he went to the premiere up at Sundance, and afterwards he was like, Jared, you're such an idiot. That wasn't even funny. Because there was so much autobiographical family material. My mom was like, well, that was a lot of family stuff. Quite embarrassing. But yeah, I mean, so I had all of that to kind of draw from. And that, you know, the Napoleon character, I think, is the dorkiest version of me and my brothers or friends of mine growing up. And, you know, we were in film school and had seen John. You know, he was in a couple of our classes and he'd performed and acted in a few other student films and just thought it was really, really funny. And we got talking and, I mean, just everything clicked right away. John also comes from a family of boys and totally gets the mouth breather that exists in all of us.
Yep.
And just could bring it to life in such an authentic way that you just believe that this was a real person. And I don't think anybody else on the planet could have done it other than John.
So, John, when you first heard of the character or the idea for the character, what did you think about it? What were your first, like, when did you first start thinking about it? And I don't even know what you started doing physically first.
Well, I think Jared, you know, he gave me the script for Peluca the short. And he kind of gave a little quick description of just the world, who this character was. And Jared, in typical fashion, he would just kind of give it in his voice. You know, be this kind of over the top, like, this is an idiot. And he would just put on this voice for 1 second, but the second I heard the voice and the second I read the script, and, you know, this is a 7-page script. It's not a ton of meat there, still, in the few little bits, like, we completely synced, I believe. I still never come up with a perfect word of, like, is this, you know, kismet? Is this, like, perfect meeting? I don't know what else to say besides that I was like, yeah, I get it. I know who this guy is. This was me and my brothers. I mean, he told me the same thing. He was like, oh, this is me and my brothers. This is who I got a lot of this from. And I felt, yeah, this is me and my brothers. I did all these things. I made boondoggle keychains at scout camp made tons of them. And my brothers, I have two younger brothers who were always just like, they never opened their eyes. They were all squinting and they're all just like, Mom, Dad, why do we have to study scriptures at like 5:30 in the stupid morning? It's retarded. And, like, you know, we got to get to school and it sucks. And it was just that attitude. It was like a quick snapshot. And I'm like, yeah, I know exactly. And I've been waiting to see this character on screen. And it was very much a lot of myself as well. Just remembering whenever I was pissed growing up.
Perpetual anger and annoyance.
Yeah.
Yes.
Of a prepubescent or pubescent teen.
Or TO'd, I think you meant, right?
TO'd.
Yeah. TO, just constantly feel like you have like an older brother who's just poking you in between the shoulder blades and you're just like, knock it off. And it was just capturing that, you know, 1 second. And then when Jerusha mentioned the perm, I was like, oh, okay. Now this is falling into place.
Were you intentionally ironic when you were writing it? Like, did you think about it in those terms?
No, not at all.
Yeah, because it comes across like, oh, it's twee, it's ironic, it fits in this kind of Wes Anderson sort of moment.
I mean, to me, it was just being as authentic to the environment and the characters.
They were all real people to us.
Yeah. And they were real stories, too. Yeah. Again, it was
Every character autobiographical.
I mean,
Uncle Rico was a real person.
Yeah, when we were filming,
Kip was a real person.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like Kip was based on Aaron Rule, who played Kip, his brother, who really did buy a time machine of some dude in Florida on eBay. And it did electrocute them. It did not work.
Yeah. Jeremy, I wanted to ask you, let me bring you into the conversation now. As you hear these conversations about why it is this film worked like it did, why do you think? Why did this resonate so much for so many people? Why did it become such a hit, do you think?
I think what we said before, it's a very authentic, but at the end of the day, it's a very like good-natured, sweet, funny film, and I don't think there's a lot of that out there. So a lot of it was just timing. I mean, the fact we premiered at Sundance, I always thought was strange because it just doesn't seem like a film they would normally put in competition, which is why I think it did so well because it was just so different from what people had done. And just every stage, it's always surprised us. And like, you know, it's always exceeded expectations. And even now that we're talking about it 15 years later is – you know, we didn't think about that when we were shooting it 15 years, 16 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And to Jeremy's credit, he believed in it when Jared and I didn't, because he was editing it, and it was really rough when we submitted it to Sundance, and Jared and I were like, no way, it's horrible. And Jeremy loved it, and he thought, this is great.
I want to ask you about the place, Preston, which is a place, of course, and it's set in a place, but it seems like it's set in kind of any town, Intermountain West, right?
Sure.
And it seems like to me it's like one of those only films that portrays life in the rural Intermountain West in a way that seems real to me, at least at the time when I first saw it, and not connected to any sort of comment necessarily about conservative culture or Mormon culture necessarily, even though a lot of the slang would be recognizable to people who live in rural Mormon communities or just Mormon communities in general.
Totally.
So how were you thinking about that, like just place, if you were thinking about it intentionally at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, we were drawing from our own life experience, right? Yeah. And that's the way that I talked growing up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have all these swear word replacements, which is very common in the Mormon belt.
Yeah.
And, but I think it is, too, in other conservative parts of the United States. So I think that that part resonates well with people from all walks of life in rural America. But
when someone in Brooklyn sees it, like, what do they say about it?
I think they just think that's so funny.
Yeah.
Those words are funnier than the real word.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It's like a weird, funny thing. Yeah.
We heard that from many actors after it came out. Like, man, it's so much funnier to do a clean comedy. And it's harder. And good on you, right?
Yeah.
John, what about you? Like, did these words flippin' and TO'd and stuff like that roll off the tongue pretty easily for you? I mean, you know, you that's must have been the way you talked in your Mormon upbringing.
Yeah, I mean, it was all the same. It was all the same for me. Again, we had all our different words and versions, and those fit right in the tongue. I don't think there was a lot of surprises when I read it. Trying to remember when Jared, you know, told me this or that. And I, you know, DeCroated obviously was like a bit of a shocker.
Yeah.
But then I found out, wait, you made that up. Sweet.
So, John, I don't want to over talk the character too much, but I wondered what you thought about Napoleon's secret sauce, you know, like that we were talking with Darryl about the fact that he lacks a kind of self-awareness, or maybe he does have moments of self-awareness and this deep kind of self-confidence. I'm wondering if you thought about that when you were playing it, like where he fit in the scheme of things as a character.
You know, I tried not to think too much when I was, I was just like, let's play this character as real as I can. I mean, I had a very clear vision of exactly, you know, who he was, how he sound. I mean, it's fortunate when you're an actor and you get to find a character that feels like a glove. You just slip it on, and you know, in any situation, in any scene, throw any character at them, and you know what to say. You know how to say. And that was Napoleon for me. I think, you know, in the grand scheme of things, for sure, I was, you know, I grew up feeling very similar to not just this kind of character, but being an underdog type person myself and loving films and knowing I want to see, you know, there's not a lot of movies out there that focus on the nerd. I mean, you've got a small handful of a few of these movies, but, you know, none of them either really worked or really stood out. And this is the time for this kind of movie where, he's a nerd, but he's not really your book smart nerd. He's not the glasses wearing geek who knows everything about everything. He doesn't know a lot.
But you
really
want to be a computer hacker.
Yeah. Oh, he wants to. He thinks he can hack because he figured out grandma's password once.
Right.
But he's like, oh, it's in me. I think that's deep down. Hackers inside of me. But it's all sexiness to him. He sees that, like, it's a lifestyle. He wants to put on all these different lifestyles because he's not entirely, he doesn't want to really admit, you know, just like his feeble existence is, you know, all that's going to, not feeble, but it's all that he's got for the rest of his life.
Totally. No, absolutely. I guess the question is, and I know you get this question all the time, it's like, so you're okay with being thought of as Napoleon Dynamite, like, and I wonder if that ever bothered you, like, all right, oh, this, I was great, it was a great film, but let me be thought of as something else, or have you just come to terms with that, or, I mean, how are you thinking about that?
You know what, a lot of those questions started popping up more in the past, you know, 5 years when people were like, hey, you know, it's aged a little bit more, and what do you feel about that? And I just, like, I love the character, and I love the film, and I'm extremely proud of it. And I don't think it would really stink to be stuck and thought of as a character that you just was like, oh, it was another job I did. And it was like, oh boy, did I really have to humiliate myself? This was, you know, this was all me. I put everything in it. And it's not that I felt like I sacrificed a lot. It was a different kind of putting yourself into the art sort of way. It was completely carefree. I had the time of my life doing it. And again, it was very personal. While the story and the characters in the setting were very autobiographical to Jared and them, I, like I said, it was very in line with so much of how I grew up. I was like, this is me. This is my life. And this is, again, I went to scout camp. I, you know, was pretty sweet with a bow staff, I thought. I made homemade nunchucks. I carved wooden weapons all the time. I had younger brothers. We made movies, and we just kind of lived in that world. And so it's just very personal to me. And I couldn't be happier that if I'm stuck being remembered as a character, that's the character I want to be remembered as.
Yeah. So, Jared and Jerusha, what about you? Like, how has the fact that this thing took off like it did so early in your careers, how did that sort of define the trajectory of your work?
Yeah.
Like, did you now we're stuck with this type, or are you glad you're in this type, or how did that work for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, when we made the film, we had no idea. I mean, what it was going to become. And we'd hoped that it would be a stepping stone to other opportunities. Again, we were starving film students making our first film, and we hoped that it would get our foot in the door somehow, but never anticipated it getting into Sundance and getting sold and then, you know, getting released by a major studio and then, you know, taking on kind of this iconic cultural thing that it has. But it launched all of our careers. Like, everybody that worked on the film, it launched everyone's careers, and that's all that you can ask for, and that, you know, everybody that worked on it continues to work in the industry today. And it's been amazing. So it becomes your calling card. Like, you'll always be, you know, this film made a splash, you know, and it's, you know, to be remembered for it is a cool, cool thing.
Yeah. I think part of the magic of Napoleon is that we made it with friends and we all were in the same boat. We were equals making a movie, and it was just this beautiful summer camp experience, and we all had the same experiences. We all grew up in the same type of world, and so it felt very personal for everyone, I think, because it was very ethnographically
Yeah.
Intermountain, if you would say that. So, it's magical that we were able to make a movie with a bunch of friends and that it still lives on. And I personally have a little PTSD from it because I was very pregnant. Dealing with John Heater's freaking wig the whole time. Or not wig, his real hair, his perm. But that's okay. It's a blur.
Jeremy, let me ask you the question I was talking to Darryl about before, and it's that one that it really hit at a moment for whatever reason culturally. It just it took off, and maybe it still would in the same way, but how does it hold up as far as you're thinking about it? Just film.
I mean, I think timing was a huge part of success because it's like, you know, if a butterfly flaps its wings, what happens? Because if we released a year earlier or a year later, it could have been, I mean, who knows what could have happened? Could have been bigger, could have been smaller. But, why it's regarded, I think it's just, oddly enough, I don't think there's a lot of movies like this, which is why people gravitate to it. And there's still, even there are copycats, even when people copied it, they're still not really matching the authenticity of it, which is why it's not working. People like seeing real stuff and that hasn't been replicated, and until someone figures it out, it's going to stick around. I've always thought about 10 years, if this film sticks around as relevant after 10 years, it's probably going to stick around in perpetuity. That's the kind of way. I mean, I loved Forrest Gump when it came out, and now I don't really think about it very much. Yeah. It's not that it's a bad movie. It just doesn't feel relevant.
John Heater, let me ask you this finally. One of the things you've talked about was that the way that people approach you now, either to do the character or approach you as Napoleon when you're on the street, you've talked about how it's shifted over the years lately. Now there's a kind of nostalgia for the character. Would you say something about that?
Time has frozen for me in many ways. It's, I get this a lot because almost every day of my life there's some element of it, whether it's someone approaching me about it or I'm, going to a screening for it or, something, someone recognizes. So it's just a part of me. I don't want to say it's the lack of moving on, while I can move on and go do other things, it's still going to be there every day. And so it wasn't until a few years ago where it really started hitting me when I saw fans telling me oh man, dude, I grew up watching that film. I'm like, what? You look like you're 50.
Yeah.
And no, man, I was in middle school when that movie came out. I'm like, oh man. But it really, it just feels like everybody is, there's always going to be someone, you guys touched on it earlier. There's always going to be, this is a movie that, when you do a movie about youth and about kids, almost a coming of age story, but youth, they have no real responsibility. And the charm of Napoleon is that you have this kid who has him and kind of Kip in many ways, Pedro and a lot of the other characters, we don't put a lot of responsibility on them. And that's why we like these youth movies, because they can get away. They can do all kinds of stuff. They don't have to worry. There's always someone kind of there watching out for them, whether it be, a guardian, a grandma, a parent, or even a best friend. There's a carefreeness there. And that's always going to be around. And people can always relate to that. And people, they love that. And so, they're still get it where I'm like, come on, man, I've done other movies, but people, they see that and they're like, wait, you're Napoleon, right? And it's fun to see that twinkle in their eye, that little sight of recognition, and it's great. And I think for me, it's changed. It's more of my perception as well. The way I used to kind of think, more dealing with fame than anything, not so much the Napoleon element, but just kind of dealing with oh man, this is what it means. This is what it means to be have people come up to you and this and that. But I feel like it was in the last, 5 to 7 years or something where I just, probably even longer than that, where I just kind of changed my attitude, shifted a little bit. And I was like, this is great. This brings so much happiness to people, and I love it. And And so, you know, not that I didn't embrace it before, but it's like I'm sleeping comfortably within that world.
That's John Heder, who played the character of Napoleon, of course, in Napoleon Dynamite. We also had with us Jared Hess, who directed the film, and Jerusha Hess, who co-wrote it with him. We also had Jeremy Kuhn with us, who produced it. Tomorrow night, the Utah Film Center is screening Napoleon Dynamite to celebrate the 15th anniversary. It's a fundraiser for the Film Center. They'll have there a lot of the cast and crew from the film, including John Heder and Jared and Jerusha. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.